ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT Radio, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Peggy Kniff, Executive Director of the National Antivivisection Society. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
In the last 40 years, the world's animal population has shrunk by half as humans put unsustainable demands on the earth, according to a new report. The Worldwide Fund for Nature's Living Planet Index, released earlier this month, revealed the dramatic decline in animal species and said the trend could cost the world billions in economic losses and threaten the very existence of the human species. The Living Planet Index is released every 2 years, and this year's index has the starkest warning yet of the risk associated with the decline of wildlife. The index shows a 52% decline in wildlife between 1970 and 2010, far more than earlier estimates of 30%. And it's due to people killing too many animals for food and destroying their habitats. The report said we are eating into our natural capital, making it more difficult to sustain the needs of future generations. Researchers from the Zoological Society of London looked at changes in populations of more than 3,000 species of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish, tracking over 10,000 different populations. The decline in animals living in rivers, lakes, and wetlands is shocking. 76% of freshwater wildlife disappeared in the last 40 years. Animals living in tropics face what the Worldwide Fund for Nature calls the biggest recorded threats to our planet's wildlife, as 63% of wildlife living in tropics has vanished. Central and South America show a dramatic regional decline, with a fall of 83%. And while the animals are suffering now, the long-term impact will be on people, the report said. This report and a host of others should be seen as a call for action. We need to consume less, waste less, farm more efficiently, use water in a much smarter way, and reduce our overall footprint.
In a related story here closer to home, Wild Earth Guardians reports that as part of ongoing efforts to protect the iconic Rio Grande and the river's full complement of native species, they're submitting a scientific petition to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service requesting protections for the imperiled Rio Grande sucker under the Endangered Species Act. The Rio Grande sucker is struggling in the beleaguered Rio Grande, and the dire circumstances of a multitude of native Rio Grande species should be a wake-up call to take better care of our river, according to Taylor Jones, endangered species advocate for Wild Earth Guardians. One of three cornerstone native fishes, the Rio Grande sucker evolved side-by-side by the Rio Grande chub and the Rio Grande cutthroat trout to fill different roles and niches in the Rio Grande ecosystem. All three species are at risk because of dams, diversions, and human land uses, which are altering the Rio Grande and making it inhospitable for native fishes. Climate change is exacerbating the serious threats to the species, including drought. Increased temperatures, increased human demand for water, and decreased spring runoff are all projected throughout the Southwest. Wild Earth Guardians are working to give the Rio Grande sucker and other native Rio Grande fishes the needed protections of the Endangered Species Act, which will ensure their survival in the face of the severe threats the Rio Grande is under. For more information, go to wildearthguardians.org.
Missouri's campaign to roll back farmed animal protections approved by California voters ended last week when a federal judge in Northern California dismissed the Attorney General's lawsuit challenging California's Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act, or Prop 2, which passed in 2008. California voters helped pass Prop 2 so that farmers would have to make sure egg-laying hens, calves used for veal, and pregnant pigs can lie down, stand up, fully extend their limbs, and turn about freely within their enclosures. Shortly after the passage of Prop 2, in a surprising victory, the California General Assembly voted to require eggs sold in California to meet the same requirements as those produced in California. Rather than advise egg producers to improve the living conditions for millions of animals raised for food within their borders, six states decided to litigate. Last February, the Attorney General of Missouri and five other states filed a federal lawsuit to overturn Prop 2. In April 2014, Farm Sanctuary, Compassion Over Killing, and the Animal Legal Defense Fund filed an amicus brief in support of the state of California's motion for dismissal of Missouri's lawsuit. In dismissing that lawsuit last week, the judge ruled that Missouri could not sue California because the lawsuit could only benefit an unidentified number of egg producers' private economic interests, rather than the state as a whole. In other words, the Attorney General's transparent attempt to harness the political prowess of big agriculture did not work in California federal court. Due to a phase-in provision, Prop 2 is not scheduled to go into effect until 2015. Therefore, any eggs sold in California after January 2015 must be raised in the more humane conditions afforded by Prop 2. The judge's ruling will allow Prop 2 to go into effect next year and thereby improve the lives of millions of farmed animals throughout California and the United States. Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Peggy Kniff, Executive Director of the National Anti-Vivisection Society, or NAVS. NAVS works to increase public awareness about animal experimentation, promote positive solutions that advance humane science, support the development of alternatives to the use of animals, and in cooperation with like-minded individuals and groups, effect changes which help to end the unnecessary suffering of animals. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas Radio is Peggy Kniff, Executive Director for the National Anti-Vivisection Society. Thanks a lot for being with us, Peggy.
Oh, it's an honor. I'm looking forward to talking to your audience out there. It's a real opportunity for us.
Well, why don't we start out by having you tell our audience a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues?
It's been part of my life, it seems like. I grew up knowing about the use of animals in research from as early as I can remember because my father was the business manager for the National Anti-Vivisection Society. So even as a child, as soon as we were old enough to stuff envelopes, I came down to help do that for our holiday appeals, and I can remember stamping third-class mail red ink on pink envelopes to this day because it was an organization that literally operated on a shoestring. And many years later, one of the founders of the organization passed away, and my father was asked to take over the organization. We were almost bankrupt. There was very little money. We got a newsletter out. That was about it. And I was asked to go on the board of directors because of my experience as a city planner with the city of Chicago. I did program development, so I thought I could come in and be helpful. At the same time, the organization received a very generous bequest, which finally put us in a position to really undertake some positive programs. We started a foundation called the International Foundation for Ethical Research, which funds the development and the implementation and validation of alternatives to the use of animals in research. We started legal legislative programs. Our communications just expanded by leaps and bounds. But I believed in the mission of this organization, having seen the old newsletters with horrible photos of dogs used in experiments where they planted second heads on them, and monkeys whose heads had been kept alive after being decapitated from their bodies. And it came from the sense of, this is not good science. it wasn't just a compassion for the animals, but the thought that we were putting people on the moon, we were curing diseases. There had to be a better way. And I felt an organization like the National Anti-Vivisection Society, even at the, in my mind at that time, even if we couldn't end all uses of animals in research, we could start implementing better ways. You know, stop testing cosmetics on animals as an example. So I've been involved literally since I was a child in school, and I knew I believed in this as early as I think about the sixth grade. We had a debate, and the topic was vivisection. Fortunately, I was assigned to the side of the issue that was against it. And among these children, I read a poem that our organization had published about a dog that had survived the war and one of the soldiers whose lives he had saved. He finds when he's in medical school, there's the dog on the table being dissected. It's a poem called Rags. It's on our website. It's very emotional. Well, that's all I needed. I had everybody, including the nun who taught our class, in tears, just reading the poem. So, again, you learn the lesson that this isn't just an intellectual debate of do we value science more than compassion. It is an issue that touches our hearts once people know about it.
Peggy, I'm sure some of our listeners are unfamiliar with the term vivisection. As I understand it, it used to refer to experiments done on live animals, but now the meaning has changed somewhat. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's one of those words that has evolved to represent a broader definition. Back even in medieval times, animals were cut open, usually dead animals. That's what we refer to as dissection, still done in many of our classrooms around the country. Vivisection referred to cutting open an animal while it was still alive, in a sense just so that people could understand how these different organs in our body work together. Over time, the use of animals in research has expanded tremendously since really after the First World War when we started testing chemicals on animals. Later in the 40s, we were even beginning to test cosmetics and personal care items on animals. So this field has developed and grown so much, in part, I hate to say it, as a result of the Animal Welfare Act, which legitimized the use of animals in science. It regulated it, but in the process of regulating it, justified it, funded it, and has actually required the use of animals for testing certain things like pharmaceuticals. So it's become part of a whole process that's made this an extremely challenging issue to try and basically change the course of science.
Yeah, it's such an ingrained idea that we need to test on animals. Recently in the news, the company Field Roast that makes vegan products was denied the ability to sell in Canada because they hadn't tested their product on animals.
Yeah, I just read that yesterday, too. I was like, wow, that is really strange. But I guess Tofurky changed their formulation of their recipe so they could sell in Canada. That's what the article I read said. But the Field Roast Company, they want to try to see if there's another way around it so they can retain their original recipe and not have to test it on animals.
There are some wonderful stories out there about companies that resisted having to test their products on animals. Toms of Maine, which produces toothpaste, went through that whole process because the FDA wanted them to test their product on animals like everyone else, and they successfully fought that, and to this day they're still a cruelty-free company. I have to say that, you know, we could almost become overwhelmed by this issue. So many tens of millions of animals are used around the world. Places, you know, what we used to think of as third world countries like China are now getting involved in doing more and more testing and changing the requirements so that companies that had stopped testing on animals now have to pay a licensing fee in China to distribute or manufacture their products, and the Chinese government is requiring that they be tested on animals. So in theory, these are no longer cruelty-free companies, but we're working to change that. There are some wonderful scientists going over to China to teach their scientists, especially in the academic world, about the alternatives, how they're validated, how they can be implemented, and we're very hopeful that it will not take China as long as it did the United States to come to accept and validate these alternative methods. So there is progress on the forefront, but it's going to take pressure continued pressure from consumers to learn who does, who doesn't test on animals, and use the power of their purse strings to choose to buy products from those companies who do not test on animals.
Earlier this semester, when I was teaching an invertebrate zoology class, we always do invertebrates in the news, and one of the students found an article where they were testing mascara with a protozoan, because it's a protozoan that lives in your eye naturally, and so it makes more sense to test the mascara against that protozoan that lives in your eye than it would on a rabbit. So that would be a way to move from using rabbits to using single-celled, short-lived protozoans.
It makes much more sense.
Not a whole hell of a lot, though.
Oh, the suffering is very different. You know, first of all, a rabbit is very different from a human, and these animals are kept in stocks to keep them from moving. They don't have the same tear ducts as humans, and the evaluation as to whether this is abrasive or just an irritant or anything else is a very subjective test. What looks red to you might look pink to me, and it just does not make sense. Science should be much more objective. And what they're doing now on the in vitro level, and in vitro is another one of those Latin phrases that means in a glass rather than in vivo in the body. And the technology that's taking off in science now, these tests are not only better and more accurate, they're faster and cheaper for testing things from cosmetics and different chemicals and formulations to chemicals in the workplace and in industry. So the alternatives that have been developed to replace their use in cosmetics testing are now being applied in other industries. And they've gone from looking at something in a two-dimensional cell culture to these fabulous three-dimensional cultures that are like organs on a chip. Liver cells, lung cells, heart cells, using not just that they're human cells, which should be far more predictive, but they're getting to the point where these will become personalized, and they will be testing these chemicals on your heart cells, your liver cells, simply by taking some skin cells from you, reversing them back to grow as organs. Eventually, they are now going to be linking these different systems together. They have to work on metabolic issues and things, but you'll now be able to run a chemical basically through a whole human body in these series of chips and things at record speeds. We're on the forefront of that, but our argument, when I have an opportunity to meet with people in Congress who funds where research goes, to people at the NIH and FDA, is stop putting your money in trying to genetically engineer animals to be more like people. Develop these alternative systems, not just because they're more humane, but because it's better science.
Right. And this has made the news recently about the organs on chips and some progress we've made with stem cells. It just seems ludicrous to continue to test on animals when it's so inaccurate.
It does. We go back to human nature. A scientist, like anyone else, is usually very, very specialized. All they know and understand is the data that they can produce using a particular strain of mouse or rabbit. They haven't been trained on this new technology. So our best hope is to get to scientists as early in their careers as possible to see the advantages of all these new alternative methods. It's coming. One of the things our organization does every year, which I just love, is we give out Humane Science Awards to the top high school students in this country at the International Science and Engineering Fair. Last year it was in Los Angeles. Next year it's going to be in Pittsburgh. These kids, as adults, have gone on to win top prizes in science. Our winner this year was featured on the Ellen DeGeneres show recently and received an additional fund because of her work on cancer research. This is now a freshman in college. It's so exciting. Year after year, our winners who have done projects that did not rely on the use of animals, they used alternative methodologies, have gone on to win prizes from other industries and universities, which again demonstrates that the humane science is better science. So we're encouraging these kids to continue on in science and do great things without harming animals.
Well, you know, I think in thinking about the youth, it seems like there might be an impediment to some going into the scientific community because they're not comfortable with the idea of vivisection, and this seems to really take away from that problem.
That's been my goal all along. In the past, I don't know if you remember years ago, I think it was in about the 80s, a young student in California named Jennifer Graham protested having to dissect an animal in the classroom, and she was going to be given a failing grade. It was litigated, settled out of court, but as a result, the Animal Legal Defense Fund started a dissection hotline. NAVS contributed to that, and eventually our organization took it over because it really wasn't part of the mission of a legal advocacy group. Things have changed dramatically. I wanted to encourage the very student who doesn't want to pursue a career in science because of the potential to harm animals is the very kind of person we want to stay in science. Whether they go into medicine or research or something else, their ethical concerns will make them better at what they do. But in the past, there weren't many things they could do. If they weren't forced to do dissection, they were sent to the library to count how many kernels were on an ear of corn or to read an article in an encyclopedia. It didn't encourage them to stay in science. Today, we have so many resources out there that are encouraging these very people to stay in science.
Well, tell us about some of the high school projects that you guys have worked on.
Oh, the young woman that we had recently was doing research on cancer. One of my favorite projects was actually a student, this was last year, who was concerned about a problem with dogs. I wish I knew you were going to ask me about this. I would have had my notes in front of me. She was able to, in grooming her dog and brushing it, use the stem cells she could get from their hair to see if they were going to be predisposed to hip dysplasia.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
So that was good. There was another student who cared so much about her cats, and her mother was very allergic to one of them, but not the other. So she did tests to see what it was. People have presumed it was the cat dander that caused the allergy in people, and actually it's the saliva. And when they lick their paws and things like that, that's what gets on their paws and causes the allergic reaction. So being able to do a swab test to determine which cats had the saliva that caused an allergic reaction and which ones didn't, her hope was to come up with a commercial test that she could take to rescue groups and sanctuaries so that people who would come in and want to adopt but were afraid of their allergies could be steered to those cats that didn't have that saliva.
It's amazing. It'd be neat to see, where these students go after this and these projects. And I think about if many of them move on to medical schools. What's the climate like in medical schools now in terms of vivisection work?
It's tough. You can get through medical school today much easier without harming an animal. The Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, another amazing organization, has provided us with a list, and they have it on their website. You can get through medical school now, and they list all the schools that don't require it. But you have to work at it. You have to stand up and speak out that you're not going to do something else, and you'll find an alternative way to do it. That's one of the exciting gains we've had. I think the fact that you can get through veterinary school without harming an animal is more illustrative of how far we've come, because someone might say, well, if you're going to study, treat dogs, maybe you have to use a dog. But they've come up with some really creative programs. Surgeries where they spay and neuter animals to make them adaptable will teach them surgical skills without harming an animal in the process.
Interesting. Well, that's great news because a tremendous number of animals were probably previously used, especially by vet schools, as you said.
Oh, they used to break the legs of healthy dogs just so people could practice setting them again. I'm hopeful that we're getting away from that. I'm not saying that we're at the end of the road and it's going to be all happy endings in the near future. With the economy being so difficult, funding drying up for a lot of research projects, university medical schools and vet schools are desperate for funds. I've heard stories that they'll do just about any kind of experiment or test just about any kind of thing on animals if they're paid enough money to do it. That's what keeps these institutions going. So I know my work is cut out for me for the short term and probably even beyond my life expectancy. But I do see progress and I do see hope.
Well, tell us a little bit about the project you guys were involved with where you were taking iPads into school so that students could see different technological alternatives to dissection.
Well, I think, the federal government is very hyped up on the STEM research, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, because we know for our country to compete around the world and keep our leadership position, we have to educate students who are bright. So there's a real push to introduce technology into the classroom, not just for science, for everything from history to math and everything else. But we worked with this one school in Florida, and they contacted us. They wanted to make sure that no student was going to harm an animal. This wasn't a question of choice for those students who didn't want to do it. It was going to be for all students. And so we helped them purchase iPads and charging stations. They had the software, and that's how they're teaching their students anatomy and physiology. And the great thing is these programs are human relevant. Yes, they can look at the anatomy and physiology of a frog or a fetal pig, but what they're trying to do is move them into human anatomy so that they can learn more about how to keep their own bodies healthy.
Right.
For the long term. So it's a win-win all the way around. And what they came back with is they see this as also a cost savings.
Yeah, exactly.
The specimens are expensive.
Very expensive. Yeah, I know that from our department alone. So these are great things for students to try. And what other kind of education outreach projects do you guys do at NAVS?
Well, I would invite any of your listeners, students, teachers, just concerned parents, anyone, come to our website. It's www.navs.org, and we have a whole section about animals and education. We have a program we've called BioLeap, which is to take biology education to the next level. We have a free loan program of all kinds of alternatives, three-dimensional plastic models, software programs, so that if a teacher just wants to try one of these out and see how it works and test her students to see how the students perform using alternatives versus traditional methods, this is a great way that they can do it in a cost-effective manner. I think the most common species today are still frogs and fetal pigs. Some classrooms will get cats that they claim are from, you know, euthanized cats from a shelter. The students want to get into human medicine and learn about the human body and all these developments in science that weren't even taught when I was in school, because the science that's so exciting is at the genetic level. And this way they're not spending all that time cutting open an animal. So we're working to try and demonstrate and prove over and over again that these alternative methods are better methods. But we find that dissection is still very prevalent in our school system. There's a presumption that it's required to get into good colleges, or that state boards of education require this, which is totally wrong. No college requires it. No state board of education in our country requires it. And any testing that we've been able to get the questions for do not rely on any specific expertise or knowledge you would get from cutting open an animal. I think this is a real good area and phenomenal opportunity for people who care about animals to make effective changes. So call me, you can come to our website, contact us, and we can send you information to take to your local school so that they can investigate this themselves. I have a philosophy that, you know, among our values in our country are compassion. We care about animals, but we also like choice. So we're not working to ban dissection outright. We want people to come and choose, number one, to be more compassionate, but also choose that this is a better educational tool and it's going to result in better science down the line.
Great, Peggy. Can you tell our listeners again where they can go to learn more about your work?
Thank you. I appreciate that opportunity. We're at www.navs.org.
We've been talking with Peggy Kniff, Executive Director of the National Anti-Vivisection Society. Thanks a lot for being with us, Peggy.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
If you'd like to try a more humane and compassionate diet, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso will be having a vegan bake sale at the El Paso Food Day on October 25th. Hope to see you at our booth there.
Also, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso is having its annual Compassionate Thanksgiving Dinner on November the 15th at the Sunland Park Holiday Inn. Our special guest speaker will be Victoria Moran, author of a number of books on vegan living, and operator of the Main Street Vegan Academy in New York City. To learn how to make reservations, go to our website, vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the Earth, the Animals, and a Healthier Humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.